This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A great deal of Michigan history has been interpreted as a seesaw of power between the urban powerhouse cities and the suburbs where a privileged few aspired to live. Oakland County in southeast Michigan is doing a radical rewrite of that script. For decades, a Republican enclave for white people of means, Oakland's exploding population and economic base have paved the way for a shift to the left, even as the county's GOP leans hard right. Michigan native Zach Stanton is a deputy editor at Politico, and he's just written a profile of the county that goes deep into past and present. Zach, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, there may be folks hearing us today in other parts of the state or even other parts of the country who aren't really aware of Oakland County's identity and history, especially with respect to Detroit. How do you describe Oakland County to people who aren't from around here?
So that's a question that I asked pretty much everyone I interviewed for this piece, in part because, you know, I grew up in Macomb County and I had a pretty clear idea in my mind of what Oakland was. And, you know, I was born in the mid 80s, but growing up in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, you know, Oakland always had a certain sense of swagger. It was a very wealthy county. It still is, but it was one of the wealthiest counties in the United States. It's a very large county. It has about 1.2 million residents. And it has a mix of just really densely populated suburbs in the inner ring outside of Detroit, as well as some really wealthy small towns and developments in Bloomfield, Birmingham, Troy, and then also a lot of just like small lakefront towns and some rural populations here and there in between. But it's undergone a tremendous boom over the last, you know, 50 years or so. And some of that initially was because of white flight out of Detroit before the 67 riots even. And a lot of it in most recent decades, a lot of the growth has been as a result of huge economic growth in the county, much of it taking place in the high tech industry, in the medical industry. And all of that has really transformed the politics of the county.
Part of what makes the sea change in Oakland County politics so interesting is, as you point out, this is Mitt Romney country. This is where Ronna Romney McDaniel, the chair of the U.S. Republican Party, grew up. And it's now effectively in Democratic hands, although on a margin that's not conceivably irreversible. Can you recap what election results looked like in Oakland County over the past three or four presidential contests?
So one of the interesting things that's happened in Oakland County is that starting in 1996, it began to vote for Democratic presidential candidates. It voted for Bill Clinton, voted for Al Gore in 2000, very narrowly for John Kerry in 2004. But, you know, Obama won it twice, even when Romney was running in 2012. Hillary Clinton carried it, and then Joe Biden carried it by a tremendous margin in 2020. But what has happened over the last couple decades is that whereas you used to have the situation where Oakland County would vote for a Democratic presidential candidate, it would still reelect like Brooks Patterson, who was the very powerful Republican county executive. It would reelect Republicans down the ticket. And what has changed is that you've begun to have Democrats win these down ticket races. And that has really transformed the county. It is, as you noted, this place that was once this quintessential Republican stronghold, as one of the people I interviewed described it. It was the place where George Romney moved his family in the 50s, where Mitt Romney grew up, where several generations of the Romney family have lived. And it had this identity as this place of a lot of country club Republicans. It's always a bit more complicated than that, but a lot of country club Republicans, a lot of wealthy business class Republicans. And over time, you've seen that type of group begun to sort of be alienated from the Republican Party, particularly in the Trump era, which was kind of a tipping point. Where you began to see them just feel that the party doesn't really speak to their interests anymore in quite the same way. They aren't seeing themselves in sort of the Trumpian culture war dynamic that has been going on for the last few years. And Democrats have really been quite successful at making gains all the way down the ticket in Oakland.
The story provides a really illuminating recap of the rise and career of the late Brooks Patterson, as you mentioned, all-powerful county executive for many, many years in Oakland County, a guy who was just a master at turning culture wars to his advantage, but who also lived long enough to find some other gears and reemerge as a sort of more middle-of-the-road pro-business Republican who was just like, let's just get things done. Was there anything you learned about Brooks Patterson writing this story that you didn't already know?
there is so much about Brooks Patterson. The story that I published for Politico this past week was about 9,000 words. The first draft that I filed was more than twice that long. And I would say all of the words that were cut were mostly about Brooks Patterson.
Zach, you are an editor's nightmare. Let me just say.
I am. I chose my editor very carefully on this one. He was very polite, but said, Zach, there's no way we're publishing 20,000 words on Oakland County, which I understand. Brooks was such a larger than life character. You know, he was impossible to miss if you grew up or lived in Metro Detroit's media market for, you know, 5 decades, pretty much. And what I had known about him, of course, was that he got his start with some of the anti-busing movement in the 70s. But the real depth of it, I had been unaware of. You know, the National Action Group, which was this organization that he was the lead attorney for, was started in Pontiac by a woman named Irene McCabe as a reaction to this ruling from Judge Damon Keith that was going to force busing within Pontiac schools in order to integrate elementary schools, which were, generally speaking, segregated. And Brooks, who fairly recently had been fired from the prosecutor's office, he was in his early 30s, really hopped on board this, initially seeing it just as a way basically to pay the bills. Like he saw this PTA-style group of all these concerned white parents and thought, you know, these are people who are going to need wills written and are going to need legal help on this, that, or the other. And so it was a way basically for him to get clients. But it became this sort of crusade that really, you know, catapulted him to the front pages of newspapers across the country. And I had been unaware of things like him having meetings in the Nixon White House with Irene McCabe and John Ehrlichman, or, you know, all the national media coverage that he got in the 70s because of it. I was aware of some of the local coverage, but he was really a national figure in some ways. And I spoke with a historian at Dartmouth who's an expert on busing and has studied this. And he's cited NAG, the National Action Group, as kind of this turning point in the way that we talked about busing as a country, in that Brooks was really able to manipulate the media to understand what made a good sort of packaged story for the media. And NAG, which was predominantly led by housewives in the Pontiac area, really provided just this great visual contrast for people. It was a great story in many ways. And so when you had this, at one point, 620-mile-long march from Pontiac to D.C., you know, it was something that ultimately culminated in a rally in Washington, D.C., that didn't have great turnout. They only had about 1,000 people show up.
Wow.
But all the way along the entire march, it got huge and huge amounts of coverage. And so it was this really tremendous return on investment. It was a media success, even if it wasn't a protest success, if that makes sense. And
yeah.
What you see from that is Brooks just having this tremendous ability to understand how to get media attention, to understand when to be outlandish, to understand what it takes to really package a debate in a way that is to your advantage as a politician.
And this was at a point when Oakland was really defining itself as a sort of opposition voice to Detroit and
yes.
and a class of black elected politicians that were coming into prominence in Detroit. It's really stark. I mean, looking back on Brooks Patterson's years in Oakland County, or the way things changed after his death, are there some lessons there that the GOP or maybe anybody wanting to win in Oakland County needs to pay attention to?
Well, I think one of those lessons is that, you know, the city versus suburbs type talking point just doesn't have the same salience it used to. For a long time, it was to both sides' advantage, really. I mean, you saw this in the fights between Brooks Patterson and Coleman Young, who was, of course, the first black mayor of Detroit, where each of them, they sort of traded barbs in the media. It was sort of a headline war between the two. And both could be outlandish, and both understood how to get attention for their outlandishness. And that worked to their political advantage, but it really didn't work to the advantage of the region. You had a very clear divide between the city and suburbs. And what you've seen, certainly in the last few years, is those divisions just don't really make sense to a lot of people in Oakland or in Macomb or in Detroit anymore, where they don't bear animosity. People in the suburbs generally don't hate the city of Detroit. They have affection for it now. And so you're seeing, because of that, real shifts in all sorts of attitudes on all sorts of issues, things like transit, things like, you know, even the M1 rail. You, for a long time, had a lack of consensus about whether or not it was even important to try and redevelop downtown Detroit. I mean, Brooks famously in the 80s, among the many kind of outrageous things he said, you know, if I never had to cross 8 Mile again in my life, I'd be fine. Detroit doesn't mean a damn to me anymore. Mm-hmm. And you can't imagine a major suburban politician talking in the same way nowadays because people just don't think that way anymore.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Zach Stanton. His latest profile in Politico is about Oakland County. It's titled with a quote from the story, "As long as the party embraces Trump, it's going to have trouble." At the same time, there are Republicans in Oakland County and Republicans who've been successful. Mm-hmm. Could you tell a little bit about what you observed, the Republicans who have been able to hold on in Oakland County, what they do and how they feel about the National Party's direction?
So Oakland, I should note, as part of Brooks's ability to attract economic development to the county, has really had a demographic transformation in some ways. And a lot of that has come as a result of the emphasis that he put on attracting highly skilled jobs, and attracting college graduates, and attracting the medical and life sciences industries to Oakland County. And you've had a huge influx of immigrants to Oakland County. You've had a huge influx of people in particular of Indian American descent, Chinese American, Korean American, and that has affected the demographic makeups of some areas that were traditionally Republican, places like Troy, which, you know, you think of Troy, you may think of like the Somerset Collection or, you know, right, sort of these swanky suburbs. But Troy in 2020 was, you know, just as Democratic in terms of the statewide vote, delivered just as many votes to Democrats as the city of Flint. And that's a different way of thinking about it. And so what you've seen is real success on the part of some Republicans who've been able to adapt to that demographic change really well. I spoke with Senator Jim Runstead, who represents, among other parts of Oakland, the Novi area, which has had a similar influx of Indian American people. And he talked about, you know, one of the things he's done is, frankly, just like show up and talk to people. And, you know, he's talked about going to Bollywood dance-offs and things like that that are in his district to just communicate to the people that are there that are part of these communities that I see you, you're part of this community, I value you. And he really spoke with frustration at the direction that much of the party is headed in, which is just not even showing up for these things. And in his eyes, you know, a lot of the things that particularly the Indian American community was interested in are things that are traditional Republican values. But if we're not showing up, he said, then it's logical that they're not going to vote for us. You know, and we need to at the very least show up. And increasingly what you're seeing is, you know, a national party that is headed in a direction that isn't as embracing of diversity as perhaps the local party would like, or perhaps even parts of the national party would like. I mean, famously after the 2012 election, the RNC commissioned an autopsy to understand what happened and what the Republican Party should do to become more competitive nationally. And one of the things they advised was to bring in a more diverse coalition of voters. And then 4 years later, Trump got elected doing very much the opposite of that. And so you have this debate and this identity crisis going on within the GOP over what the right approach is, both from an ideological point of view, but then also from a strategic point of view. And you're seeing that play out in places like Oakland.
Well, at the same time, Republican strategists have said to you, among others, that, you know, what's happening may not be what the Republican Party has looked like, but it is working in places like California, in places mm-hmm. like Florida. I mean, is it possible that what's happening isn't that the Republican Party has turned away from Oakland County, but, you know, because of the siren song of Trump, but maybe because places like Oakland County are not as important nationally anymore?
I mean, that is the argument that some people make, is that you do simultaneously have, as Oakland County has moved further into the Democratic column, you do have places like Macomb County that have moved further into the Republican column, or places even like Genesee County, which have become more battlegrounds than they traditionally have been. But the other way to think of it is that these vast, wealthy suburbs of places like Oakland, affluent suburbs, are places that they really need votes, not only for presidential elections, but for congressional elections. Oakland County has parts of four U.S. House seats in it, and all four are Democrats now. Just a decade ago, two of those four were Republican seats. And so if Republicans want to take back the House, whether it's in Michigan or elsewhere around the country, they do need to compete in some of these battleground suburbs. And if they're not making the inroads that they need to, then that's really going to set them back as they try to retake Congress.
Yeah. You note that there are a number of down ballot races that have gone the way of Democratic candidates, especially Democratic women. And you profile candidates like Marie Manoogian and Mallory McMorrow, who've come into their own in the state legislature. But overall, it feels like the change that's happened here has been on the right. What happened in Oakland County's Republican Party after January 6th? Can you give us any signposts for which way the county party is trending?
Yeah, so it's difficult to separate the end of the Trump era from kind of the end of the Brooks-Patterson era. You know, Brooks died of cancer in 2019. And since then, you've begun to see a real vacuum in the Republican Party in Oakland County. And as a result of that, there's been just sort of a default to Trumpism. And people who were on the very Trumpy side of the party have been able to go to great heights now. One of the people you've seen is Michonne Maddock, who is now the co-chair of the state Republican Party, but you know, had been the chair of the Republican Party in the 11th Congressional District and is on the executive board of the Oakland County Party. You know, she was someone who organized buses to take people from Oakland to Washington, D.C. for the Trump rally that became the riot and insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And a month later, less than a month later, frankly, she was elected co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party. So what you're seeing a lot of the time in the Republican Party, whether it's in Oakland or throughout the country, is just this inability to have an identity separate from Donald Trump. And that is, on the one hand, good for Donald Trump, perhaps, but on the other hand, is not great for a lot of Republicans down ticket, because they are already having a hard time carving out a place for themselves. Every politician kind of is when we have local media in many places kind of dry up. And that prevents local candidates from making an independent identity for themselves. And it just makes everything sort of filter through the lens of the national media. And so if everyone is basically just judged vis-a-vis Trump, that is going to be hard for a lot of Republicans who may not be where Trump is, who may be more moderate and maybe, you know, may have different views about things like diversity and may not speak in the same way that he does. It makes it more difficult for them to carve out their own niche. And that is a problem in places like Oakland County, for sure.
Zach Stanton is a deputy editor at Politico. You can read last Friday's story titled, "As Long as the Party Embraces Trump, It's Going to Have Trouble," at Politico's website. Zach, it's always great talking to you. Thanks for this article. I learned a lot.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.